Now, what on earth do you do when you're young, brilliant, ambitious, and female in medieval France? That's the dilemma facing the heroine of Mandy Hager's new novel, Eloise. Based on new research into the life of Eloise d'Argenteuil, this is a new take on a well-known story, and it's got some very modern questions at its heart. Mandy Hager reads from Eloise.
France, 1098. The girl crouches in a field, oblivious to the pigs that rootle in the trough behind her. Not yet five, she has forgotten she is tethered, a rope at her waist tied to the gate to curb her daydream wanderings. She pays no attention to the man who turns off the road and pauses for a moment to stare at her before he spurs his horse towards the dwelling beyond the trees. She is intent upon the world she builds from carefully placed mud, forming mountain ranges like those she sees to the north in a river given life by murky water she has carried from the pig's barrel in her cupped hands. Trip after trip she has made, imagining herself God as he formed the earth, and now she is satisfied with the water's level, she starts to shape crude huts along the river's banks, mixing in straw to recreate the texture of the walls that enfold her at night. She does not belong here, she knows this much of who she is, but nothing more. This uncertainty chafes at her daily, despite the care meted out by the woman who has fostered her. The woman has eight offspring of her own who vie for her attention by taunting and jostling this cuckoo's child at every turn. The world Eloise builds with such ferocious concentration will have no place for them. It is a world where voices rise only in merriment and hands pass food, not steal it from her plate behind the woman's back. A world more like the heaven described by Father Onfray, the black-robed priest who visits monthly to collect their tithe and instruct them in God's laws. He reads them stories from the holy book. She memorizes them to tell the pigs, the only ones patient enough to listen to her imagination's constant outpourings. The thunder of an argument erupts from the trees. She drops her smoothing stick and backs into the milling herd. They nuzzle her, bristles tickling, sniffing the tight-strung rope, and she strains to reach for the runt, her favourite. The storm grows louder and the man now charges down the path, chickens flying. Her foster mother chases at his heels. This is not as it appears. The woman flushes scarlet as he throws the brushwood gate open and makes straight for the cowering girl, pigs scattering and squealing. He snatches her from their midst. I take great pains to care for her. This is for her own safety. She gets an idea in her head and wanders off. You call this care? Look at the state of her. She is filthy. The girl struggles against him, but his big hands make short work of freeing the knot around her waist. She has failed to loosen it despite prolonged attack. Have no fear, child, he says. I have come to take you from this place. If you had sent me warning, what, and give you time to hide her? But her family have paid. Family? He spits, the gob landing by her foster mother's dirt-blacked feet. You speak to me of family? This is my sister's child, and those who cast her out will rot in hell.
So when I got this book, I opened it and I read the first sentence, and it said, the girl crouches in a field, oblivious to the pigs that rootle at the trough behind her. And I thought, rootle, what a great word. I'm going to enjoy reading this book.
That's nice to hear.
Is that a word you made? Is that an actual word?
I don't know. I didn't go and look it up. It just seemed like the perfect word for what those pigs were doing, really. So I left it there.
I think when you're writing a book about writers, particularly people who are so well educated and so precise in their language, the obligation to think carefully about the language that you're using must be nearly overwhelming.
It's pretty terrifying. And I wrote the whole first draft in a kind of heightened 17th century language that I matched to one translation of the letters just to get my head out of modern thinking. And then when I got to the end of it, then transposed it back into third person, more kind of modern speak, but had kind of removed the modern world from my head. And that worked really well just to get me into the feel of the time.
It's a kind of credibility gap, isn't it, between getting a, as you say, a slightly romanticised medieval tone, but also having believable modern-day characters that we can relate to.
Yes, and I think I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and actually it was very helpful because as I was doing the research and was looking at the politics, particularly the politics around the story, I realised that in many ways it was mirroring a lot of stuff that's going on today, and that reading into their letters and reading the kind of stuff that they were reading, they really were very sophisticated in their thinking, and that perhaps the only thing that is different between us now and then is that we have better technology. So this idea that people in the 12th century were somehow less able to think in a sophisticated way was quickly dispelled for me, and I just thought, I just want to tell this as a story of real people coping with the situation at the time.
Well, we're talking about real people who spoke multiple languages and have spent a lifetime in study. It would be
yes.
a little false of us to look down our nose at them.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. The key to your intent in writing this book, and I think you referred to it also obliquely just before when you talked about the politics, the key's in the title, isn't it? This isn't Abelard and Eloise, this is Eloise.
Absolutely, and I think that it became really clear when I was reading. There are numerous biographies about them. There is Helen Waddell sort of wrote this seminal English language version of their story in the 1930s about Peter Abelard, and it was always from his point of view. And as I read that, I thought, who was this woman who had this amazing intelligence and was incredibly well educated and well read? How could she have coped with the situation she found herself in? Because the love affair that most people know about was only 2 years of her life, and she lived for 71 years. So how do you recover from the enormous amount of losses that she had in her life? And that's what interested me. I just wanted to dig in to the psychology of that woman, who I think is an exceptional woman for any time, especially given that she was in the 12th century.
So when you dug in, what did you find?
I found this woman who really was a feminist. And it's interesting because when I first started researching, I went and talked to Constant Muse, who is one of the world's experts on their writing and stories. And he looked at me down his glasses and said, you must not tell the story through a 21st century feminist lens. But what I discovered was this woman who fought for other women, who supported them at times when things were incredibly difficult, who built up a community to support the women around her, who introduced women saints into their celebrations within her convent, and who really explored a philosophy of how she was going to live with the world and came up with this decision to only ever work from an intention of love. And these seemed like extraordinary and wonderful things to me, and a very kind of inclusive and modern perspective on life, which I think is why people have been so fascinated in the letters that they've read, because she says extraordinary things like, I would rather have been your whore than the Queen of France, saying that I want to be valued for the love we have, not the position I have. And these were outrageous sort of feminist statements coming from this woman at that time.
And yet you talk about there being the love affair only taking up 2 years of her life in real terms.
Yes.
But Abelard's all through this novel, isn't he? Her yearning for him, her missing their child, and emulating him, and in some sense in the end overtaking him as well.
Yes, I think so. And actually humanising him, I think. So I think that clearly she loved him deeply and didn't want to let that love go, but he also caused her enormous hurt. And so I think that when she finally managed to get communication going with him again, so there was 10 years where she heard virtually nothing from him, that she slowly re-engaged him in the relationship by realising that he was not going to engage with her on a romantic level, and that she had to hook him back in intellectually, and that's what she did, and said, you know, you put me in this position, now you must support me and the women that I am looking after, and re-engaged him in rewriting rules for the way that they lived, saying that, you know, we're women, we're having to live with this set of monastic rules that were set up for men, but they don't suit women. Help me find a new way for us to live. And just slowly pushed him to actually find a bit more humanity in himself than I think for most of his life he practiced.
Well, there's the humanity, and then there's, as you referred to, the intellectualism inside there. There's a wealth of quotes in this novel from theologians, writers, philosophers. Is this a field you're ordinarily familiar with, or did this take quite a lot of extra work?
This took 18 months research, so no, but it was absolutely fascinating. So it was a labour of love, and I felt...
Sure. The reading alone must have been just a great pleasure.
It was fantastic, but that's the other thing that Constant Muse has said to me, that if you are going to tell this story, you have to immerse yourself in all the stuff that she would have read in order to understand the way that she thought and to try and get that sense of her voice, because she was just so well known for throwing these quotes in everything she wrote and said. So it was great, and I feel like in the process of writing the book, she's given me a gift as well, because I now have this wealth of knowledge that I'd never have had if I didn't pursue this story.
There's always that question of whether there's interest in this story still. It's been around a long time. You've touched upon some of the politics around it. But during that 18 months of research and writing and thinking, you must have found something new.
Well, I think so. I think for a start, there's only been a couple of novels in the past that have been written from her point of view, and they basically focus on the 2 years, and they're a bit kind of bodice rippery. So I wanted to explore it from her point of view and really dig down into what it felt like for her. But also you have to look at it within the context of the time, and that's something that hasn't been done before, saying, well, what actually put the pressure on them? Why was it that they could not continue to be together? What were the forces acting against them that caused this great rift between them and could easily have destroyed her life for good, but she managed to somehow pull it back together and find some meaning in it. So that hasn't really been explored before, and it hasn't been looked at in terms of the full breadth of her life and what she went on to do after the affair with Abelard, which was extraordinary in its own right.
Well, a great response, and to some extent a great response on her terms, but still very much within, I don't know, the constructions, the strictures of 12th century France.
Yes, yeah. And there was no doubt that those restrictions got harder and harder as her life went on. So at the beginning of her life, people seem to think she was born at the end of the 11th century. And over the course of her 71 years, women's power and women's rights really degraded over that time. So at the beginning of that time, women could own property and have some kind of personal power in a 12th century context. But over the course of her life, that was pretty much taken away. And so by the end of her life, women had been kicked out of convents and their wealth taken away. They'd been stripped of all rights to choose who they married. So really, by the time her life ended, women were silenced for another 400 years before they actually were able to find their voice again. So it was a very kind of pivotal moment in women's history in France at that time.
So the point is not that Eloise fought battles and won, but that she fought them at all and won some battles.
Well, that she fought and survived, and I think found a way to find peace in herself, because she had so many losses in her life. It could easily have destroyed her and made her bitter, but somehow she managed to get out of that a sense of neighbourhood and community with the women that she ended up with, and a generosity of spirit, so that she, within her small field of capability, she educated them and helped lift them up as much as she could, which was no mean feat in those times.
You researched, and I imagine partly wrote this while you were in Monton on the Catherine Mansfield Fellowship. That's very close to the Italian border, isn't it? Very close to the Mediterranean generally. So I imagine the refugee question was sort of right there for you.
It was literally in our faces. So where we were staying was 5 minutes from the border, and we had a railway track and a road below us and a road above us. So every day we watched refugees, young people, they were all young people, mainly young guys trying to get across and being chased back. It was ugly, and it was upsetting, and it was really confronting, because we could cross the border backwards and forwards without even being looked at twice. We could take trains and we were never questioned, but the train would stop at Monton, a truckload of police would leap out of their van and walk through the carriages and haul anybody off with dark skin, and it really brought home the level of the crisis and the desperation of the police. And that whole question about, you know, how you control borders, should you control borders, at what point does compassion set in? So it was an interesting backdrop when then looking at the politics that was going on in the 12th century, which was very similar in many ways. There were big movements of people. There were the First and Second Crusades. There was a rise of fundamentalism. There was a lot of corruption and abuse in the church. There was a huge consolidation of wealth back into the state and church coffers and away from the middle class. So all these things that were going on that felt very kind of familiar to me when I was reading about them happening to her, it kind of feels like you can look towards worst case scenario America at the moment and see similar things playing out. We've been there before, we haven't learnt this. Let's get this right and actually use history to move us forward instead of this repeating cycle. To actually be there and walk through it really brings it home and makes it, instead of distant history, when you can walk through a building that's still there that she walked through at that time, and to think about what the architecture's intention was. So these magnificent churches were not just there to impart the awe of God, but also the power of the church. So this whole kind of issue of power and control is the never-ending cycle. You know, do we just want that to continue, or do we want to actually say, no, there's another way? We can select other values at our core.